Ready graphics? Ready theme?
Hi, I'm Jessie Mullins.
And I'm Lauren Milberger.
And this is FYI,
the Murphy Brown Podcast.
Murphy's outfit in this episode is my everything.
Jim is back.
Yes. I'm very invested in their sex life.
Get the M&Ms. It's a happy candy.
He's so good. And on today's episode,
we'll be talking about season 3, episode 7, The Last Laugh.
Part 2. A back courtyard patio of, you would assume, of a well-to-do kind of East Coast house. There's some white metal chairs and a bench and a small table where you might entertain. And there's, you know, walls on either side of it and a tall kind of wooden door that you would imagine to kind of keep an area like that private on a private home. And we hear the dulcet tones of one Murphy Brown struggling with a dog. This is Trickster, the Dials dog.
Trickster also is not a fan of Murphy's right now.
Yep. Also, Murphy's outfit in this episode is my everything.
I mean, her relax outfits are always great.
Oh, the white turtleneck, the like hunter green kind of puffy anorak style coat. The hair is back. She's got some gold hoops. This is how I spend pretty much every fall is this outfit. So like, thank you, Murphy, for representing.
I mean, this is the season that they win best costumes and it's
for
so
a
obvious
reason.
Why.
So she kind of makes her way in. And right at that moment, we see Doris enter the patio.
Doris.
Now, I want to say at this point, we don't know where she's coming from. So you may assume she's leaving the house. You'll find out in a minute that she's not. And we just hear her in her very Doris voice. Now, everyone, if this is Janet Carroll, the great Janet Carroll, as Doris Dial, if you haven't listened to our coverage of Going to the Chapel in season 2, please do. We talk a lot about Janet's career. She's incredible. And just her voice as Doris is so iconic. So just her going, Murphy. Never. It's so
not happy to see her.
No, there's very much a chastisement in this voice. I love the way Murphy even responds to Doris as like a maternal figure because of where she holds Jim. And you can tell she also doesn't want Doris upset with her.
No.
Which I love that. I love that there's this, we're always playing against, and we have this, we just had this with Avery as well, with this kind of fighting against the assumptions of housewives of this time. And we see this in Doris as well. Like, Doris is not someone to write off. Not that we should write off anyone for their how their life ends up. You know, it's, we don't know who someone is just based on how they occupy their day. But I just love this idea that, you know, if you're going to make an assumption about a housewife, please look at Doris and Avery and tell me that they're all the same.
Right?
You know, like the way she speaks to Doris is with equal respect as anybody. So Murphy apologizes for surprising her in this courtyard. She rang the doorbell, but there was no answer, so she let herself in through the back gate. Doris firmly reminds Murphy that she told her over the phone Jim isn't taking visitors and she should go. Murphy says she needs to talk to him. He hasn't returned her calls in the last 3 days. She's really worried about him. Doris proceeds to say, "You're worried about him. Last night they were showing Oliver on TV. Halfway through it, Jim started heckling the orphans." Murphy didn't realize it was this bad. Now I want to ask, which Oliver do you think they were watching?
There's more than just the 60s movie?
Well, because there have been multiple adaptations, but that's the one I'm assuming. Is that the one they were watching?
Yeah, I'm assuming
like the famous
musical.
Yeah, the famous Oliver.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially if they were playing it on TV. Murphy says she didn't realize it was this bad. And Doris goes, didn't realize. Let me tell you about my last 72 hours. Jim doesn't leave the house. He's constantly under my feet, dismantling the vacuum cleaner, organizing things in the refrigerator by size and fat content. This afternoon, he terrified my bridge club by wandering into the living room in his underpants. I love him dearly. Oh, she starts toward the door Murphy had entered in through. She says, I love him dearly, but if I don't get one uninterrupted hour of privacy very soon, I can't be responsible for my actions.
Doris, I love you.
She needs her life. She's so great. And before we get any response from Murphy, Jim appears through the door Doris had just left. We now see that it's his workshop, not the house. And with a, Doris, I can't find my wing nuts. Murphy.
I'm sorry. That's such a, I can't find my wing nuts.
I can't find my wing nuts.
It's like such an old joke, but I just love it.
I love it. Jim is in his casual gym clothes. A little bit later, we will share with you the biography that Charlie came up with for Jim, which includes that this was kind of his original vision for how Jim dressed.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. which is I called like he's got Mr. Rogers sweater over a button up shirt, but the top button is open. He's got a working apron over the top and some safety goggles, some big old safety goggles on.
Yes.
Both wilts and purses his lips together and just darts back inside.
He's like a child in this scene.
He really is.
But like, that's not an insult, right? Like, yeah. It's just, I think he's so vulnerable. He's a person. I was just going to say that. Yeah, he's so vulnerable and he's been taught not to be vulnerable. And mm-hmm. so he feels embarrassed by his vulnerability mm-hmm. when he should be proud of it.
We will do more, but just something within this, within the book that we talk about, the Murphy Brown Anatomy of a Sitcom. Mm-hmm. That he says is Jim's feelings are very near the surface. He is easily offended. He is very sentimental, more of a softie than he would ever admit.
Oh, I agree. I think that's what his issue is. He's fighting against the softness that mm-hmm. he has
and he's
with what he feels he needs to be a man.
Yeah, and he's always been able to protect that side of himself. Or at least, yeah. even if it does leak out, he always recovers. And it's very interesting to see this moment where he wasn't able to recover and kind of salvage the moment. Yeah. So Doris tells Murphy she should go ahead. Maybe she can get through to him. Murphy thanks her and goes in. And then we don't follow Murphy into the shed right away, into the workshop, I guess I should say right away. We stay with Doris, who shuts the door and padlocks it. And we just hear Jim on the other side go, Doris, Doris. Oh, Doris, not again. She says, it's just for a little while, dear. I'll let you out after I've washed my hair.
I love that she just needs some quiet to wash her hair. Like, I so appreciate that.
I love that it implies that she's not allowed to wash her hair alone.
Well, I think the issue is that he's acting like a toddler.
No, I know.
He's bothering her at every... Yeah, okay.
I'm very invested in their sex life. I just love them so much.
I'm so naive.
I think the actual joke is that he's being like a toddler and he just probably like sits in the room and talks to her.
You would like to think that they do it in the shower.
I would like to think that he's just there, you know? I'd like to think that he's trying to distract himself.
Well, we should put a pin in this and really bring this back when we get to the novel.
We are now inside the workshop and Jim, mouth pursed, is pointedly refusing to speak to Murphy. He grabs a piece of wood. I believe it's a 1x1. Brings it to the table saw. Ooh. I grew up building things with my dad. I love this scene. Actually, I love that you know all this.
This is great.
I talk a lot about my relationship to my own mother and to watching this with her and the representation of the incredible women in my life. But this in particular so sends me back to being a kid with my dad. We were always building on our house. I have such mm-hmm. strong memories of these tools in particular, and especially learning how to use the table saw with my dad, the sound of that. The second he started using it, I knew Aww. The smell of it. My dad was also yeah. somebody who was very, very soft inside, very tender and sentimental and hurt easily. But my dad was born in 1942, so he is very close to contemporary and was someone who was raised to be a certain type of man that was, I think, that particular form of toxic masculinity was very harmful for. My dad was, you know, a Marine and was trying to be everything, you know, a quote unquote man was supposed to be for his family. And one of the ways that he processed and showed creativity and busyness was carpentry and building things and doing that. He built all the sets yeah. for my community theater where he also performed because big softy. But the smell of the wood, the sound of the cutting, the him tinkering with something as an outlet was so familiar to me that like this particular moment I knew exactly what was happening in Jim watching this.
Yeah. And it's interesting because I don't have the same personal like connection to this and I know nothing about building sets, but when you said the smell, mm-hmm. I had a flashback of college and, you know, you had to walk through the shop
yes.
to get to the stage. And I just like, oh, yes, you're right. It is mm-hmm. very evocative, that yeah. particular sawdust set yeah, smell when they're...
Yeah, it's like you hear the sound yeah. of the table saw go down and then you smell what that wood smelled like as it was heated and cut.
I would also love to talk about, I went back and listened to the monologue or the conversation that Murphy and Jim have in Roasted. Mm-hmm. Because when I see this scene, I thought, well, wait a second. didn't Jim say that he's not good with tools? Mm. And now he's making all of these windmills, right? Mm-hmm. So I wanted to go back and see exactly what they talked about. And this is something really interesting, because the reason he says I'm no good with tools is Murphy is trying to encourage him on what he can look forward to in the next half of his life.
Yep.
And she says, do something new, find a hobby. And he says, I'm no good with tools and I hate to fish. So that means that he took her advice and he decided to learn how to use tools.
Well,
and it's so beautiful. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think that's a really strong headcanon, and it's definitely one that my brain has gone down before. I think there's also something notable about, unlike my father, who did kind of stereotypically masculine work with these tools, with the, like literally building walls and that kind of stuff. I also think about the fact that Jim isn't doing big macho construction pieces. He's building tiny windmills.
Yes, that's true, which like, is very sweet.
I'm curious about if there's also a potential to kind of yes and, which is that his idea of being good with tools is like rebuilding cars and building buildings and doing these big macho
that's
things.
That's fair.
Not making sweet windmills. So I'm curious if there's a like, he's not good with tools, but he's good with this very delicate, sweet creation hobby, which I think, I wonder if that's like, he took that from Roasted, decided, like, actually took the, like, get, find the hobby, find the thing, but he couldn't go as far as something cliche, as far as, like, what a macho man would do. Like, I don't think building these tiny windmills is what a macho man would do in his mind.
I mean, that's a really good point. I guess I feel, as someone who is scared of a jigsaw, that to me is a large, complex tool to use, I guess. Mm-hmm. I think both can be true, right? They're both valid. And what also gets me is Murphy particularly says, you gave me this last year, right? Mm-hmm. So we know that it's something that he possibly could be doing. But I do love that too, because you're right, and I hadn't thought about that, that it is kind of a very sort of sweet thing to do. But also I want to bring up something that we'll talk about when we get to that episode, though, but just to put it in people's heads and ours, is that also in that conversation, she says, travel, write a book.
Mm-hmm.
And he writes a book this season.
Someone went, noted.
Yeah, so that's why that caught me too. I was like, oh, these are things that we see this season. But I love your headcanon also, because it totally works.
I think for mine, it's just a yes and of what you already said.
Yeah.
I'm going to wait to read this, because there are some things in this biography that he came up with that tie into this idea of...
Oh, they do? Oh, great. I purposely didn't read it so that I could be surprised.
He basically... Well, I'll read this little section because we can always continue on.
Please, yeah.
He says, he worshipped his father, and in college he started to smoke a pipe, and he decided on scotch and water as his lifetime drink because his father drank scotch and water.
I remember that, yeah.
Manly things would be his choice from a very early age. Most sports are boys' games, but golf is a man's game, so he would be a golfer. He probably smoked until his wife Doris forced him to give it up, because smoking is what other manly journalists do. So yeah. I love this idea of, for me, it's the, he was inspired to get the hobby, he was inspired to work with tools to do this kind of thing. He went, he bought the manliest tool he could think of, which was a table saw. Not a jigsaw, but a table saw. You know, like just straight,
thank
easy
you for
cuts.
Correcting me.
Yeah. You know, this type of thing. And then his actual investment in the stereotypical manly pursuit made it about that far. And then he started making beautiful things like dollhouses and windmills.
Oh, I love that.
You know? Because
yeah.
also I think about the idea of like, now I just want to be very clear, and I don't think anyone actually is worried about this, but just in case, like, we don't think that building windmills is not masculine. Like, obviously, masculinity is as much a spectrum as femininity. Expressions of gender are not limited to one art form or pursuit. But I think we are coming from the perspective of what he was told was masculine, what he believes is supposed to be masculine. And I also think about, like, I absolutely see Jim as that sweet older man we all see who, like, builds his grandchildren dollhouses, you know, should they have had them, that kind of thing. You know, like, I imagine he he built things for Avery. You know, like, like, I believe that maybe this Veterans Day a windmill made its way into Avery's room. You know, like, I love the idea, because I do think there's that beautiful thing that we saw some of these older gentlemen of that generation get to show their softness as they became the sweet old grandpa types. And so I imagine this was maybe Jim's evolution into that expressed softness. Like, my grandpa always bought I didn't know until I was older, but for Christmas, I always got a sweater from my grandparents, among mm-hmm. the other things. And I found out that my grandpa was one who picked out my sweaters. And there were always aww. These sweet little things. And my grandma could not have cared less. And my grandpa had a really strong eye for what the sweet little girl would wear as a sweater. And they were always my favorite. And they were so fun. So I just think there's that opportunity for him to express these things that maybe are a little softer for him in this moment.
Yeah, like one of my favorite Eddie Izzard jokes is she has a joke where it's two Romans talking to each other. Mm-hmm. And it's about how she's like, I want to wear a dress. And the other Roman is like, well, we're wearing them.
Yeah. You know, like, look at us.
That's not the full joke of the way that she does it. But like, yeah, like this idea, all of these ideas about gender that we have are all based on something that is really, you know, a coined and achieved and materialized in America, in Western culture, mm-hmm. I should say, not America, Western culture, that it's made up.
Yeah.
Based on binaries that really don't actually exist, right? That, you know, things change and the ideas that people have, if it was thousands of years ago, would not make sense. So are they not less of that gender? No. Like, mm-hmm. and although at the end of the joke, she does, but I want to wear them like this. And then she props her feet up like she's in heels.
Yeah. But I think there's...
like, it doesn't make sense.
This is just one of those great moments where we see the fact that misogyny hurts everyone.
Yes.
You know, like it hurts everyone, not just those that it puts in the minority.
Agreed wholeheartedly.
So Jim is at the table saw with his one by one. Or he grabs his one by one, he makes his way to the table saw as Murphy is trying to engage about this windmill she sees. And she starts to say how she still has the one, and the table saw interrupts her very loudly. If you've heard a table saw, it's very loud. You cannot talk over it.
Yes.
As he stops, she goes, made me for last Christmas. He returns to the table, still ignoring her, sanding now in just tiny little strokes the end of the piece he just cut. Murphy makes her way over. This is one of those great sitcom setups where the table is up against the wall that is the fourth wall to the audience. So we get a great view of what he's been working on. There's a bunch of great, there's like a planer to level things out. And she sets down the windmill next to him and says that she came over to apologize. It's completely her fault. She had no idea he'd lose control like that. She's just set down the windmill. He takes it from her to add the piece to. She says it was the last thing she expected. She feels horrible. She's really, really sorry. I love the scene. It's so simply done. And Jim finally speaks. He says he appreciates this gesture, but it has nothing to do with her. And he says a line that breaks my heart, which is, I was the unprofessional one. I was at fault. I failed. Mm. And he says it again, so simply. She tells him, come on, he's not the first person to break up on the air. Murrow did it. Jim snaps back, Murrow was a horse's hiney. Good Lord.
By the way, I could not find any like proof that Murrow did left on air.
No.
No. Yeah.
He says, good Lord, did you hear what I said? I blasphemed. And what I love, he does the thing where he takes his goggles off, like it's too hot inside them with like what he's dealing with. It's like he's sweating too much. He has to take his goggles off. And he says, laughing on the air was the most humiliating, sophomoric thing I have ever done. All my credibility as a journalist is gone out the window. And this is where Murphy, being our Murphy, sometimes centering self, says it would be so much better if he just blamed her, yelled at her, let her have it. She knows she'd feel better. And Jim just sits there and says, what's the point? Nothing's ever gained by ill feelings. And then he just spins the windmill, sadly.
Such a great little gesture.
Oh, it's so good. She says he's right as usual. Let's put it behind him. Why doesn't she pick him up tomorrow? And he startles out of his seat backwards and goes, tomorrow? Is she out of her mind? He's not going back tomorrow. It's too soon. He's not ready. It could happen again. Mm. Now, I want to take this pause here. The fear of something like this happening again. Lauren, are you familiar with Anderson Cooper losing it on the air?
Well, I am now because you showed it to me before we started, because I wasn't. You know, it's funny when Jesse mentioned this, I went, oh, you mean New Year's when he's drunk? And she's like, no.
No.
No, 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 Lauren. But tell the audience.
So this is about 12 years ago now. It's the one that I always think of. But Anderson Cooper on his show used to have a section called The Ridiculist, which would just be, you know, kind of something amusing at the end of the show, which was something just ridiculous in media. And obviously, if you've ever watched him at New Year's with Andy Cohen, we know that he has quite a notable giggle when he loses it and then can't stop. And when I was thinking of this episode, I immediately thought of this moment. And this came out of conversation with Lauren trying to think of someone recently that we could think of that had gone to this level of losing it in a broadcast.
Yeah. And also just to preface, like someone at a certain level.
Yes.
There are tons and tons of video of local anchors losing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's just a very different thing when it's a main anchor. And even back then, very different, which we talked about
at the beginning
of the episode. But like, yeah.
So
that, anyway, go ahead.
And even Anderson Cooper is not at a Jim Dial, Mike Wallace. You know, he's still young enough to not have that gravitas yet, but he's still considered, you know, he has his own show. He's very respected. He's been, you know, a journalist for a long time, handles serious topics very well. Yeah, he's a Vanderbilt. So the one that I particularly had to bring up, and I talk about it here because it's the happening again problem, which is that during The Ridiculous, Anderson started being given things to talk about that he just could not control himself over. And the one that originally happened was him giggling over a quip about Gerard Depardieu and some bodily function that happened in which he was told to say the line Depardieu and he starts to lose it. But then it became a thing where he just started getting so frustrated because the one that came up was a festival known as Dingus Day, I believe Polish festival.
But Jesse, where is Dingus Day, which connects to our show?
It is in Buffalo, New York.
Hometown of Diane English.
Indeed.
Anyway, continue.
The short of this, please go look it up on YouTube. It's one of those things that I just watch when I want to feel better sometimes. But basically, he was talking about the fact that part of the traditions of this festival is girls having water tossed on them and boys getting gently hit with pussy willows. And he could not handle, he just started giggling. And the thing about it is once he started, he couldn't stop. And in the broadcast, he starts to say, this is so stupid, this is so stupid. And what he's actually talking about is the fact that he can't stop, which is very similar to Jim at the beginning of this episode when he goes, it's not funny, it's not, and then can't help himself.
Yeah.
And then he ends up going on to basically do a retraction about his giggles because the people of Buffalo thought he was saying that Dingus Day is stupid. But then the production puts a stand of pussy willows behind him for his retraction video. And he, again, can't fully handle himself and is trying so hard not to laugh again. So this very real feeling of being a serious journalist who is cracking up, breaking up on air while everyone else is watching this happen, trying to control yourself. But once it started, you can't stop. And then you go back on the air and are trying really hard for it not to happen again. That's a very real concern. And so when he says, like, it's too soon, he's not ready, it might happen again. The fear of this, and again, back to your comment about the stress relief, you know, they had just come out of Hell Week, which is he's exhausted. So he cracks on air, probably because he's finally releasing the tension of that week that they had. Now he's here in this tension of, oh my gosh, this thing just happened. And man, if you're ever told to not think about something, all you're going to do is think about the something. That's very tension creating.
And that comes up next.
Yep. So it's the Austin Powers like mole, don't talk about the mole, and then all we do is talk about the mole. So that's all I could think of. Please go watch the Anderson Cooper video. It's so funny. He's trying so hard, and the people of Buffalo were such good sports about it.
They were great sports about it.
Just so it's, if you want to feel good, just watch him have a giggle fit. So Murphy says, Jim, you're a newsman, and as trite as this sounds, you've got to get back in that anchor chair. The longer you leave it, the harder it will be. And Jim, which I love because he actually says it quite seriously, goes, damn it, Murphy, I'll come back when I'm good and ready and not before, so stop pestering me. And he pauses and he just hands her the windmill. He just finished and says, Happy Veterans Day. He goes to the door and yells out, now where the hell is Doris? Doris?
I think also the way that he chastises her is very much like he knows that she's just always been a bully.
Yep.
And this is the thing that she just can't bully him on. And
yep.
There's such history, I think, behind that. Like,
for him to actually say, like, damn it, Murphy, I'll, like, in an actual, like, put his foot down way, I was like,
he
normally, like he says later, he normally rolls with things and doesn't get flustered. And he's just like the steady one while everyone else loses it. And this is one of those moments where he's actually putting a stop to what's happening.
Should we mention the car?
Yes.
The gorgeous, gorgeous Please car do. That's in the garage yes. slash hobby room, mm-hmm. I guess, or work room. This is a 1953 MG TD. Mm-hmm. And the reason that we know this, I mean, I do love vintage cars, don't get me wrong, but we know this because it belongs to one of the writers on the show, because it belongs to Corby Siamis. She said that she has been in love with the car since she was 15 and she saw a film called Two for the Road on TV, which is an Audrey Hepburn, Albert Finney film. Mm-hmm. And it's her all-time favorite movie and she bought it in 1985. It's gorgeous. I see why she's in love with it.
I also really understand because my spouse is first generation Australian American, and his Australian father has a cousin who lives in Vancouver, and we just saw that family recently, visited them in the
Oh, that's right. Oh my God, yes.
And we just call him Uncle Mark. He's a cousin, but you know, who cares? Uncle Mark has an 83-year-old MG in a beautiful blue color. Her name is Matilda. We got to ride in her, basically. He bought her.
You sent me a picture and I yes. completely forgot. I just remembered when you said it. I was like, you yep. sent me that picture.
He bought her, repaired her, and had her shipped over from England to Vancouver. And we got to ride in her. Wow.
Well, we're putting this on the social media.
I get it. I remember
you sending me this picture.
She's gorgeous. I just have to say, because they're such cool cars. And Corby, I freaking get it now. He drives. I got to be co-pilot and I got to be the turn signal because it's a manual turn signal.
Oh.
And it's an actual switch that you flip that I got to like manual. It was so fun. It was. And we're that on these like Vancouver roads. Oh, she's gorgeous.
So we're back in the studio. Murphy is dressed in a fantastic blue suit. They are playing very calming music that I can only describe as Enya. Very particularly 1990 Enya. For those who aren't familiar.
As an Enya fan, I have to please. Interject. It's not
is
Enya.
Is it not Enya?
But I would say it is pure moods adjacent.
Oh, I like that. Thank you for clarifying. She is making sure she's scolding everybody. No smiling, no chuckling. You know, Jim needs to be focused and relaxed when he arrives. And of course, she's screaming and Murphy is not relaxed. Miles says that Jim is about to arrive. I'm going to skip over the fat joke.
Yeah.
But there is a terrible fat joke, unfortunately. But we understand in context now, you know, that is something the writers probably would not do. Frank comes in. He found Jim indecisive by the vending machine. He wasn't sure if he should say something. And he finally decides to encourage him. Get the M&Ms. It's a happy candy. Which, of course, the gang is cannot believe he did that. Like, what a mistake he's made. And then they do the joke, which we have talked about, we love, which is when someone is calling from different places. And it's like, he's coming, he's coming, he's coming. And then Jim arrives just as he's passing John telling a joke, to which he changes to, wow, all they found in the shark was her charm bracelet, huh? At least you have two other sisters. Jim is like so, I can't describe it. He's stiffer than usual. He has kind of like a sadness to his gait, like mm-hmm. as if like he's not in his body. And he's just like, so like when you're depressed so much that you just sort of like a husk of your former self. It's all in the way he's walking and the way Charles is handling himself.
It's really hard to look at because he again, such an incredible performer. And I credit this to his theatrical training. What he is feeling is from like hair follicle to toe. Like it is so full body. It's just viscerally, you know, he's not okay.
Yeah. No one really knows what to do. Corky offers to help because that's what Corky does. That she brought a picture of her cat, Mr. Puffy, in the animal hospital for Jim to look at when he needs to be sad if he thinks he's going to laugh. But the best part of this joke is that Corky pulls out the photo and goes, it's hard to see his little face because of the little respirator. And then everyone kind of leans in and Miles just, he's like, no one look at the picture. No one look at the picture. Like Frank covers his mouth. I just covered my mouth and I have a mic. That was stupid. Frank covers his mouth and just they're all trying not to laugh because it's so ridiculous, this picture. Corky knows it seems brutal and extreme, but there's nothing more sobering than seeing a loved one with a hairball lodged in his throat. John approaches the group and softly lets them know it's 20 seconds to air.
So gentle.
Everyone sits down. Hair and makeup are doing what we would call last looks, you know, checking to be sure everything's good. Murphy very sweetly puts her hand on Jim's arm to let him know, you'll do great. We're all here for you. To which Jim loses it. Like, you, if you thought he lost it before, that is not how badly he can lose it. It is like he is on laughing gas. He takes off his microphone and has to leave the stage like a laughing Frankenstein.
So true.
Because he's still kind of stiff and his arms are like out of my way. It's so great. Oh, I should also mention that, which is actually the best part, is Corky pulls the photo off the desk and shoves it in Jim's face, thinking that that'll stop him, and it just makes it worse.
Yeah, like, what is he supposed to do? Not laugh at that tiny respirator?
I mean, how can you not? So they have very quickly, Frank has to open the show, which he has never done before. It is chaos. Murphy is worried. Frank tries to open the show by reading off the prompter and also the paper in front of him about his own. That's my favorite part, is Frank says his own name off the prompter because, like, he's just, you know, really probably nervous and just reading what's in front of him, forgetting that that's him. Mm-hmm. But then he has to look down at the paper to remind himself what his story is, which is very telling for later.
Bless.
Yeah. Corky will be doing a report on Jack LaLanne, which I feel like has become more in this sort of pop culture recently. I think a lot of people probably know who Jack LaLanne is, but didn't like previously. Shows like Physical. I think there might be a documentary, but just quickly, very renowned, what'd you call, like, not a workout coach, but like an aerobics person? Like, what would you refer to Jack LaLanne?
I'd say maybe one of the original fitness influencers.
Fitness influencers. That's great. That's perfect. Now, first though, Murphy has a very special interview, and he throws it to Murphy, Frank, and then Murphy goes, one of the most painful, heartbreaking stories you'll ever hear, to which the button on the seat is Jim laughing.
It's just so good.
And then we're in Phil's.
So we cut to Phil's, and what I like, one of the first things we notice is that it's not a busy time at Phil's, which I love that they do that because he is his rushes are based around what's happening in the area, and a big part of his clientele are currently on the air. So, like, they would all rush in after, like we saw at the beginning of the episode, where they all want to go to Phil's and, you know, drink after the show. Right now, he's in a slow moment. So Phil's at the bar polishing glasses, and Jim strolls in. Phil's like, hey, Jim, you're not supposed to be here. You're supposed to be on TV right now. And Jim says he doesn't want to be on TV. He wants a good, strong cup of coffee. Black, no sugar. So I just want to call out, I love this scene because we so rarely see...
It's really lovely.
We rarely see Jim and Phil conversing in general, if not just like placing an order, but also seeing them as contemporaries. And we get this backstory with the two of them. The reason I reference this is Phil says he knows how Jim likes his coffee. He's been serving it to him for 13 years. He also knows a lot of other things about him, like when something's bothering him. And what
second time also we've heard like how long these people have known Jim.
Yes. And this idea, like, we hear a lot of comments about how Phil, like, how many people and icons Phil has served and Phil has known, and what Phil's been on the other side of, the pearls of wisdom Phil has done to actually like save the world from time to time. But we forget that Phil and Jim have been doing this dance of their routine and of their lives for 13 years. Like, we know Phil knows Murphy, but Phil actually knows Jim before many of them did. And so I love that we get to see this, because so often they're kind of both just on either side of a punchline, but we really get to see them connect as these older men surrounded by the next generation of what they're doing.
That's a good point. Yeah, that's a really good point.
So I love it. I love that it's at Phil's where this conversation happens. And Jim says nothing's bothering him. He just needed to get away. Phil goes, in the middle of a live show? And he leans forward and says, look, you've got a bartender here all by yourself. Why don't you take advantage of the situation and tell me all about it? Jim says he simply doesn't know how he goes on from here. Phil knows that it's about the laughing thing, and he asks if he's tried thinking really depressing thoughts. He says, if you haven't got any, I can tell you about my canned corn delivery today. It'll tear your guts out. And Jim proceeds to say, you know, in my career, I've covered a war knee-deep in Korean swamp water. I've reported men walking on the moon. I've informed America when one president was assassinated and another resigned. And now the only thing people will remember me for is that I found humor in the president's tukus and behaved like a ninny in front of 30 million people.
Tukus is Yiddish for ass, by the way.
Indeed. And Jim says, what is going on with you? You're too tough a guy to let this get you down. One of the things I love about this show, but also such kudos to Tom Palmer with this idea and then the writer's room for working through this script, mm-hmm. because it brings so many great quotes that I love that the show does, which is characters having moments of self-awareness that don't feel too out of left field. They don't just suddenly have these pearls of wisdom about themselves that came out of nowhere. I believe that Jim is saying this because he's been thinking about it, because he has that emotional intelligence to be able to state this without sounding like no one mm-hmm. talks like this. And he says,
yeah,
being in control has always been my strength, keeping a cool head while everyone else was losing theirs. Well, I'm no longer that rock. I can't depend on myself anymore. Frankly, it scares the hell out of me.
Oh, man.
And what I love is this is such a Phil thing. He's somebody who's been doing this for a long time. He, unlike Murphy, knows when to kind of lead the horse to water. And so he goes back and he picks up the glass he'd been polishing and says he guesses there's only one thing to do. Fold up your tent and leave the profession. Jim says, oh, he's thinking about it. Believe him. But are you really thinking about it? What it'd be like sitting on the sidelines telling people what it used to be like when you were on top? And speaking to this Jim acting a little childish earlier, he's sitting there with his arms mm-hmm. folded like he's petulant. Phil asks him, is that what you want? And Jim gets like small offended and says, of course not. He loves his work. He can't imagine not doing it anymore. Phil leans forward and goes, ah, here's the part where the bartender leans over and says one thing that makes all the difference. Are you listening? Because this is going to be good. And I love that they actually make it something really good.
In the way that Charles plays it, right? Like, he is really intent. Like, it's such a well-acted scene between the both of them.
And again, it's this idea of, like, they could have gone for an easier punchline where he says, this is going to be really good, and it's actually nothing. But instead, they actually are allowing the scenes to have some weight and some sincerity. He says, you said your biggest fear is being remembered for losing it on the air. But if you give up now, that is what you'll be remembered for. And Jim kind of looks up with this light bulb and goes, and Phil just goes, ah, you didn't see that one coming, did you? And Jim's still thinking, and he leans in and goes, ah, come on, Jim, I'm working like a horse here. Give me some satisfaction. And this is the moment where I originally wrote, I love seeing them as contemporaries, because the way Jim smiles at him and says, you're right, Phil, and goes to shake his outstretched hand and thanks him, he smiles at him like a friend. Like, they really see each other. And it's in a way that I don't think anybody saw Jim, you know, like everyone's seeing Jim from their own filters. But I think Phil was possibly the only person who could have that talk with Jim.
Yeah, because everyone else is trying to, like, Murphy is trying to absolve herself mm-hmm. more than she's trying to help him. And everyone else is more sort of on eggshells about it happening again, as opposed to treating the problem.
I say this sans judgment. Everyone is looking at Jim from what they need for Jim to get better.
Sure. Yeah, nothing's wrong with it. Yeah.
You know, Doris needs her husband back. Doris wants her autonomy back as well. Doris wants to help, but she doesn't know how because she can't relate in that way. Murphy wants to feel mm-hmm. better, and she also wants her Jim back. The team needs their leader back. You know, Miles needs his employee back. And it's all coming from good places. But Phil is the first person who basically, I mean, he doesn't need anything from Jim if Jim comes back, but he's able to see Jim in a way that without all of that in the way, and he's able to talk to him as a fellow man in the world. Phil is probably witnessing this happen with his own contemporaries mm-hmm. who have been on the other side of things. So I just think it's a really beautiful opportunity that I don't know if another show would think to use. Another show would have given Murphy the speech she has as the button of this scene, and that would have worked. Yeah. A lesser show would have, but this show gave us this.
No, it's great.
So Phil says he better hurry. They're closing out the show. And we get an old Jim. Oh, good Lord. And he starts to leave and he's grabbing his stuff. And Murphy arrives in her beautiful blue outfit. Oh, I'm obsessed with this blue outfit.
It's so good.
She declares she's been looking for him everywhere. He says he's got to go. And he starts out the door. And Murphy thinks he's still avoiding her. And she says, keep running away. But let me tell you something. I'm not giving up on you. I'm going to be right here, stuck to your side like you were with me until I checked myself into Betty Ford. You were in the cab, in the plane, trying to get me off the luggage carousel in Palm Springs. I love you, Jim, and I love you. So stop acting like a big baby and go back to work. I also love that this frickin' show took a speech like that and didn't make it precious.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful speech. It has so much behind it. And it's just a punchline to get to Jim going, okay, let's go. And he takes out the door and she turns out. She goes, I'm getting very good at this.
Can we also talk about this backstory about Murphy, right?
Exactly.
In season 9, they say that Jim drove her across country. Mm-hmm. Betty Ford is in California. So I guess we can assume that this all happened because she says to get me to agree, right? So
says, just like you were with me until I checked myself into Betty Ford.
Yeah. So once she checked herself in, so to speak, mm-hmm. or, you know, made an appointment to go, he's the one who drove her mm-hmm. cross country.
Yeah.
I think that at the time they wrote this, it was supposed to be that she got off the plane in Palm Springs, which is not, yeah. I don't think it's that close, but it's the same state. But is there something funny about him just dogging her and then finally she gets home and is finally like, all right, already. And then he has to drive her back to California.
I just love them. I love their backstory together. I love the idea of like when Jim gets intractable, the idea of Jim just like refusing to leave her side and all of the ways that Murphy would try to get away yeah. from him.
I mean, maybe so she good. Got banned for a couple of months, so he had to drive yeah. her.
I'm trying to imagine if she was on the luggage carousel because she was wasted or if she was on the luggage carousel because she was trying to escape him and get back on a plane. Like all of the reasons why she might be on the luggage carousel
yeah.
are also good.
I like
good
to think she was wasted. Yeah.
And maybe it's both. Maybe she is just blitzed and also trying to escape him. Like that was her escape. Was she like?
I think actually, yeah. I think both could totally work. Yeah. So we're back in the studio. We see on the monitor that Frank is on location. For those of us in the know, we know that Frank is not on location, but he is standing outside the studio on the Warner Brothers lot because yeah. all those studios look the same from the outside. Still very, very good. Mm-hmm. Use what you have in front of you. Frank is so enamored with himself.
Oh, he loves watching himself.
Just loves it. And he's so enamored that John can't get his attention to look forward that they're back now from the report. And he turns around when he finally gets it. And, you know, he goes, that was something, wasn't it? Which leads to them going to commercial. John crosses the frame saying they're out and into commercial. 1 minute to close on the Frank Fontana hour. I love this because this whole section, it just so succinctly lets you know what has been going on and has not been good.
Mm-hmm.
Miles says that they're, you know, almost home free. All Frank has to do is close the show. Frank asks for the copy, but there is no copy. Jim just wings it because that's how great Jim is.
As we saw at the top of the episode.
Yes. Frank, though, has not been paying attention to anything but himself.
Yeah.
And so he can't summarize the show because he has no idea what the show was. To which he asks Corky, and I love because this is so not something Corky would usually do, which again shows like how insufferable he's being.
Mm-hmm.
She mocks him. Let me see. What was my story on? Was it about Lincoln? No. Was it about you? No. Like she just, and then Jim arrives. Everyone's so excited. Jim is there. Murphy says everything's going to be fine. They're going to do this. They're all just sitting there waiting for the show to start. And then, of course, everybody is on the verge of laughter. They try to settle. They try to bring it down. Miles is like a school teacher trying to get them to be quiet, so to speak. It's about to erupt. And then Corky snorts. And then they all lose it.
Gone.
The crew loses it. Frank, Corky, Murphy, everyone but our man Jim.
Professional.
Who goes through the entire ending of the show as his old self. The show ends and he walks away in this cacophony of laughter with a lovely smile on his face.
Oh, the way he like walks out like he's walking through like a receiving line.
Yeah.
Like everyone just losing it and mm-hmm. he's just slightly smiling to himself. Oh.
It's so great. You people are unprofessional.
You people are unprofessional. He's finally
Jim
back.
Jim is back. Yes. So now is a great time for us to talk about, apparently, according to Diane and according to this book, the Murphy Brown book that we always discuss, Anatomy of a Sitcom, Charles Kimbrough was the only actor to come up with a full backstory for his character.
Full backstory. I could honestly take up so much of your time just reading the entire section about Jim Dial. So we're in the section of the book called The Ensemble Cast, The Characters. And Jim's section itself is called Jim Dial, The Anchor That Sometimes Soars. he at one point says it was like Andy Hardy. Somebody had given us some money and we were going to put on our own play. It's been like that ever since. There was also a great quote he said about doing Murphy Brown.
And this is from October of 1990, so it's very close to when this episode aired. He said he could see doing Murphy Brown for about 964 years. I'm very happy in it, and I love getting paid and getting to work every day.
Which I would have watched him play Jim Dial for 964 years. This is not some brief quip about who he is. I'm going to read a lot of this to you, and I just think it's so beautiful, and I think so much of it shows up in this episode. He said, Jim saw right away that his key to the Jim Dial character was the man behind the facade. Quote, I felt that the front he presents to the world was there all right, but I knew that there was another creature there too. Jim's manner was something he had built up. It was the serious newsman, part Edward R. Murrow, part Ernest Hemingway, both of whom would be Jim's heroes. In one episode, Roasted, he tells Murphy a long and revealing anecdote, meeting Hemingway and being disappointed in the man behind the legend. They also talk about how Charlie, as everyone calls him, is a deep and thoughtful person who has considered his craft carefully. He talks a lot about finding his characteristics. Something that I think is notable is his struggle at the beginning was also against the notion that he might end up being a one-joke character, one who could come on every week and get a laugh for the same reason and then go away, quote, just an accent on the show. Because of that fear, it led to one of the most, I think personally, richly developed backstories for a character that could have just been one note and been fine. Jim's background was well-to-do, conservative Republican. His father was a stockbroker in Chicago, and Jim grew up in the suburb of Winnetka, going to Dartmouth, as his father had before him. Then suddenly, his father died of a heart attack, and they found out that his personal affairs were chaotic, although he had been a wonderful businessman. He was one of those excellent businessmen who left his domestic affairs in absolute shambles. Which I think says a lot about his relationship with Doris, that he is so devoted to that. It's, quote, the shoemaker's children go unshod, you know. So the family had very little money left. They had to sell the house and move to an apartment. He couldn't go back to Dartmouth, of course. So when the Korean War broke out, he decided to volunteer, planning to take advantage of the GI Bill and finish his education after service in the armed forces. Quote, his time in the army was the great liberalizing influence in his life. He worked on Stars and Stripes and then got into radio broadcasting. He came back to Chicago and got a job, and from there, he moved as an anchor to FYI in Washington. Had his father not died and set in motion that whole train of events, Jim would have been an insufferable bore. Journalism humanized and liberalized him by showing him a way out of his little niche, especially as he saw how other people in the world had been struggling to live. Now Jim is something of a liberal, in common with Murphy, although he is not demonstrative about it. As Charlie puts it, quote, Jim is very noncommittal politically, just as many practicing journalists are, but he's probably more liberal than his dress code or his general background would indicate. His taste in music is somewhat commented upon in the series. Charlie feels that Jim would like swing bands, again, the same music his father liked. But he has learned some more recent music from Murphy. Quote, all of Jim's knowledge of Motown, of rhythm and blues, comes from Murphy. I think that when they first got to know each other, they would probably go out and lift a few and talk. And she probably taught Jim a thing or two about music, the way she did with Miles in the pilot. But he still only has a couple of numbers, and he only does them with Murphy. As is included in the sequence in the Men's Club episode, Soul Man. Jim will never be avant-garde, yet he has enough vanity to succumb to little trendiness. In the manner of clothes, for example, he wears Giorgio Armani suits, which he is very careful to have properly fitted and creased and generally elegant. Quote, at first I thought of him as someone more conservative than that, says Charlie. Not that sleek, but that kind of fastidiousness, vanity, in a way, is a whole other dimension added to the character by Diane and the costumer. At first I was uneasy with that. My idea was that around the office he would wear an old tweed jacket with leather patches or a cardigan equally used, and that he would only get into his real threads, probably conservative Brooks Brothers, for the broadcast. But instead we want the Armani touch, and I've come to like that. It means he preens a little bit. There's always a minor tragedy if he spills something on his clothes, perhaps because it spoils the effect, but more likely because a truly fastidious person just doesn't like spots and stains. Quote, but he is rather shy. Certainly he is awkward with women. His description of the character is so full, so carefully thought out, and above all, so plausible to those of us who have seen Jim Dial that it really does invest in the character with a believable past, at least for those lucky enough to hear Charles Kimbrough sketch it in. And that's just part of this section. It's so good.
Yeah. And obviously, you know, some of that changes, just like Candace had an idea of her backstory that Murphy was a
army brat, right? Mm-hmm. And that was changed. So, but it's still important as an actor to sort of have all that underneath, because it helps you inform all the choices that you make within the script.
Well, and you see it, like, what I love is, like, these things that he chose, they just added more as the show went on. So, like, he was keeping that inside. He had these ideas. They would show up in design and that kind of stuff. And then they were so satisfying and added so much more nuance to his choices that the writers couldn't help but expand upon them. It made it impossible for him to be a one note. And I just think it's so beautiful.
Exactly. Yeah.
Obviously, I love Charlie Kimbrough. I knew I liked this episode. I'd always liked this episode because it's so much Jim and it's so special to me. But upon rewatch at this time in my life, it's just even better. It's just, we're so used to, and we've said this in this season already, like, there are episodes that I was, you know, prepared to be surprised by because I didn't remember much about them. But I didn't think I didn't think this episode I could like more. And surprise, I can.
I always knew this was a great episode. I think that if you asked me before this, like, what are the great Jim moments? Like, I would say it's a great Jim moment, but the novel's my favorite. Mm-hmm. But now I think I'm leaning towards this one, mostly just because having the privilege of going through the series with you, Jesse, mm-hmm. and seeing Jim and Corky in a way that I never saw as a child, and whether that has to do with just being a child, but also how amazing you see them, mm-hmm. that I have so much more respect for Jim and Charles' performance mm-hmm. in a way that I just didn't notice as a kid. And it's really been quite beautiful. And I just think his performance in this is great. And it's sad to me that he wasn't nominated for an Emmy this year.
Yeah. I
think it's just because if you look at who's nominated, there's some people who don't usually do television. And I think that it was just a very hard year.
Mm-hmm. He's so good this season. He's so good in general, but like, especially with this episode, it's honestly a shame to me. Shocking no one, I will just shout to the rooftops how incredible Charles Kimbrough was, but especially as Jim Dial. And it's so much more than just being lovable and being funny. Like, the depth that he brings to this episode is, it's such a love letter to his generation. This feels weird to say, but I think it's such a love letter to his gender and those who struggle with what that means mm-hmm. across the spectrum. This episode is so much of why I love Jim, and I watched it and I was like, ooh, I can't wait to make my spouse watch this. Like, I'm just so excited. It's so good. I also wanted to, speaking of his perception at the time, there's this great piece from Entertainment Weekly that named him one of the VIPs of 1990. So this is from 1991. It's got this great picture of him where he's sitting sideways on a director's chair doing a closed mouth cheesy grin to the camera with his tie flopped over his shoulder. And it says, 3 seasons into his role as Jim Dial, the anchorman who yearns for journalistic sonnets in a world of soundbites, Charles Kimbrough can now admit he was a little tight-lipped and morose in his first year on Murphy Brown. He was a fine Broadway actor, a Tony nominee for Stephen Sondheim's company, but he was new to L.A., new to TV, and nervous. Quote, I was jealous of Joe and of Faith, who was instantly adored. I counted every line I had, he recalls. These days, though, Kimbrough, 55, has stopped counting. He knows, and we know, that whatever Jim utters would be utterly Jim-like. Jim is Murphy's knight in three-piece armor. Oh, I love that line. He's a gent of another generation, one who stands for principles like valor, integrity, friendship, with Irving R. Levine. The NBC veteran once appeared at a Dial roast. He's the ballast that lets his FYI colleagues let loose. He's funny because he's serious, and he gives great anchorman voice. There's a confidence in Kimbrough's portrayal that keeps Jim from ever going stereotypical on us. But being a gent has its drawbacks. One day, Kimbrough realized that he was the last person to hear gossip on set, just like Jim. And, he says, you know, Grant and Candace are very physical. They're always wrestling and tickling each other like adolescents. While I find myself wanting to get on with rehearsal, I think in their eyes I'm becoming Dial-esque.
It's such a great thing. You know, it's part of the fall 1991 and 1992 season, so to speak, mm-hmm. commenting on the great MVP season he has mm-hmm. to sort of showcase someone who doesn't usually get showcased. And it's something that is not available online. It's something that is kind of like Murphy Brown in a way, dissolved from
yeah.
people's memories, which is a little sad, you know, and I think it's so great we get to talk about some of these things.
I also think, like, kudos for on like a public platform commenting on like the insecurity of our career, yeah. of being like, yeah, I was like counting lines and I had fewer lines than some of the other people and I was jealous. But like, I think there's something really sweet and humanizing about this. And also, of course, in hindsight, you can admit those quirks because now you're in a better place. But I think there's something just really endearing about Charlie that he can say something like that. And it's humanizing.
Yeah. And I think a lot of us who grew up in the 90s, like Entertainment Weekly was kind of like a Bible to mm-hmm. like find a complex variety of people and stories. And it wasn't about clicks, because if you bought the magazine, you bought the magazine yeah. and then you would just read it. And, you know, when Entertainment Weekly stopped printing a magazine, it was sort of an end of an era for a lot of people who... It's so hard to explain if you didn't grow up on it, but yeah. I feel like Entertainment Weekly specifically because of the variety of entertainment, it wasn't like Premiere that was just film.
Yeah.
It was everything from Premiere. Movies and TVs to books and quotes and things like that, that it really shaped, at least for me, my pop culture education.
Totally, totally, totally. Yeah.
Yeah. So speaking of MVPs, you are our MVP.
Aww,
and if you would like to support the podcast in a free way, you can drop us a review wherever you listen to podcasts. But really, no matter how you can support us, we are so happy that you're just here with us.
We really are. We really appreciate it. We have such a good time talking about it, but we love hearing from all of you and knowing that you're enjoying it as well, because we're community. We're community-based. And so
yeah.
it thrills us. And we're so happy to be talking about this season with you. We hope you're enjoying it as well. And we look forward to the next ones coming up, because it just gets better. Thank you for listening, friends.
If you enjoyed what you heard today, please show us your support by
liking,
subscribing,
and interacting with us on social media.
Our handle everywhere is
at Murphy Brown Pod.
You can also email us at
murphybrownpod@gmail.com
or visit our website at
murphybrownpod.com.
Share us with your friends.
Give us a 5-star rating
wherever you listen to podcasts.
You can also support the podcast by checking out our Patreon.
You can donate once
or be a recurring subscriber
and access exclusive deep dives on Murphy Brown and other related topics,
as well as bonus content we had to cut for time.
100% of what you donate goes toward creating this podcast.
So any way you are able to support, we deeply appreciate.
And we'll see you next time
for another edition of FYI,
the Murphy Brown Podcast.
I miss Fresca, is what I'm saying. Okay, you ready?